my good, good friends over a very long journey. Everything we believe in and have worked so hard for is at risk here. All of the hours we have spent together, all of the lessons we have learned, all the progress we have made, all the understanding we have earned from our families and friends, all the momentum of our successes, our honor as women, all is at risk here in Houston. The weight of the lives of our grandmothers and great-grandmothers is very heavy on our shoulders. The words they might have spoken are whispers in our minds. The hopes of those young women and hundreds of thousands like them, those young women who ran those 2,000 miles carrying a torch from Seneca Falls to Houston, is a care wound around our hearts. We have before us an historic task. Make no mistake about that. Just as we now speak of Seneca Falls and the suffrage movement, women from now on will speak of the Women's Conference in Houston. We have a very, very difficult task. Those of us with concerns which have been excluded from consideration or accepted by established bodies wish to have them heard here. Those people must find our sensitivity and care. We must listen with concern to those whose pain has been turned from by the establishment. They must find love and support here. We must be open to one another's concerns. We must put aside our defensiveness, our fear, put aside ourselves, and listen very hard. We must learn to do what W.H. Auden once advocated, learn to love our crooked neighbor with our crooked hearts. And we must discipline ourselves to show our political experience. We must keep an eye on the clock. We must impose order on ourselves so we can complete this very full agenda. Every issue in our plan of action is just as important as the others. Those at the end of the alphabet have equal importance as those at the beginning. We must have a full hearing for each recommendation. But we will need to impose discipline on ourselves to achieve that end. The responsibility is entirely ours. Remember the words that Barbara Jordan spoke to you this morning, because we will, for years and generations, reap what has been sown here. Each time women meet together, we become stronger. Each time we listen to one another, we become wiser. We have been moving toward this day for 200 years. We must leave here with a message that is unmistakable to the country that is watching. We must show such courage and gallantry and maturity that America will watch this Houston conference and feel respect for the song we are singing and admiration for the singers. I'd like to ask you all to stand and join hands with one another right now, and to join with me in an affirmation of this conference. Will you follow me? We are here, America.
We are here, America.
at last to move history forward for women. With love, we will listen.
With wisdom, we will decide.
With vision and courage,
we will seek equality and justice for all.
And this time, America,
we will not be denied.
A young woman who in a comparatively short time has become a symbol of the young homemaker who is very much interested in the same kinds of things we are. Our next speaker is Judy Carter of Calhoun, Georgia, a former school teacher who happens to be married to Jack Carter, the president's oldest son. She has an advanced degree in education. She is a contributing editor of Red Book, and she's serving as the White House coordinator in the campaign for ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment. Judy Carter.
Good afternoon. I'm honored to be asked to speak with you today. I hold no office and I really have no title. I write things for Red Book when my two-year-old will let me. But mostly, I'm a housewife. And as my little boy says, just a plain old mommy. I work hard. Most of the women in this room are also homemakers and mothers. We've all mopped floors and wiped noses just like any other plain old mommy. That's an important choice, carefully made. We have some other important choices to be made here in Houston this weekend. Whatever our other differences, we all care a lot about our families. When we have chosen to build a life with husband and children, we are extremely protective of anything that might harm the security and stability of that family. The basic decisions made in each home about how to make enough money and how to spend time are never made lightly or without regard to the well-being of the children there. Our goal invariably is to provide the best possible life and the most opportunities for our children. We will never in this country be able to provide the best possible life and the most opportunities as long as women are denied equal legal rights under the Constitution. Daughters are second-class citizens the moment they are born, and we as mothers are prevented from contributing fully to their progress. Our society gives great lip service to the preservation of families. But by its laws and its attitudes, it does not, in fact, adequately value women who are mothers. In many states, women are not considered legal guardians of their own children. They cannot take any legal action in behalf of their children. Often, women are not the legal owners of anything, including their homes, which are purchased during that marriage, even if they work to make the payments on them. In that situation, women are also denied the ability to will anything directly to their children. In most states, a husband is not legally required to support his wife and children as long as his marriage remains valid. If the husband squanders the family income on himself or simply refuses to provide for his wife and children, the wife's only legal recourse is divorce. And that is a drastic step indeed for mothers who are concerned about holding their families together. The lack of protection that women have under the law is usually not evident to the housewife whose husband adequately provides for her. For most homemakers, life goes along just fine until something happens to the husband. What happens if he dies? Men have traditionally spent a great deal of money on life insurance to care for their families in case something happens to them. They usually overlook the fact that their wife's legal status without him will severely hinder her efforts to maintain for her children any semblance of the life they formerly had. Inheritance laws vary widely from state to state, but rarely does a widow have full authority over her husband's estate, even when she has worked diligently with him for many years to build it. Other laws which discriminate against women become evident when the wife becomes the head of the household, as 18 million women are right now. Fair wages, equal credit opportunities, insurance, and retirement benefits are much more important when she bears the total responsibility for her family. A widow is faced with the full responsibilities her husband had, without the same legal rights. A woman who is divorced faces essentially the same problems a widow faces when she becomes the head of the household. It is virtually certain that she will have to begin working to support her children. Her chances are about 50-50 that she will ever collect one penny of alimony or child support from her former husband. The legal system, both the laws themselves and the enforcement of them, has not adequately assisted women who must raise children by themselves. There is one change in our system that will help us all, regardless of our feelings on other women's issues. The most basic, elementary legal change that needs to be made is to include women in the Constitution. Until women are accorded adequate legal rights, we cannot hope to make the other changes that we all know are necessary. We cannot preserve our families and our churches and our other institutions that are precious to us without being a legal part of the system which protects them. The 27th Amendment of the United States Constitution seeks to correct the grave error made by the Founding Fathers in denying legal rights to women. It reads very simply, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." This amendment legalizes women. For those who do not know, the extensive investigation and the resulting legislative history of this amendment defines in detail the possible results of its passage. There are many things it will not do. Rights to privacy will not be affected. Abortion laws will not be affected. The conscription powers of the Congress will not be affected. Social and religious practices and organizations will not be affected. Laws regarding homosexuals will not be changed. Rights given under law, labor laws, Social Security, and divorce laws will simply be extended to include everyone. Congress passed this amendment, 354-23 in the House, and in the Senate, 84-8. Virtually every major religious, consumer, civil rights, women's, labor, business, professional, and legal organization in this country actively supports that amendment. Thirty-five state legislatures, which encompass 75% of our population, have ratified it as part of the Constitution. We're not finished. We need ratification from three more states to guarantee ourselves a valid place in the lives of our children. I believe that the most important vote that can come from this National Women's Conference is a resounding affirmation of our united determination to become a part of the legal processes in this country. Let us make it clear to the people of our country that a vote for ERA is a vote for a better life with greater opportunities for all our citizens. Let us make it clear that we are proud to be the mothers and wives and women of America. Let us make it clear that we care deeply about our families, our country, and their future. Let us make it clear that we will not be intimidated by fears or lies or loud voices. Let us make it clear that we will not be divided in our struggle to gain the simple fairness that our country stands for around the world. We are strong and we are determined and we will not fail. Thank you. I am going to introduce to you three outstanding women to read to us the Declaration of American Women, which is the preamble to our national plan of action. One of them, and perhaps the best known from our weekly television screen, is Dean Stapleton, who has been one of our most active commissioners. She is an award-winning actress. She has appeared on Broadway and in film, and of course, is Edith Bunker to us all. Joining her will be Commissioner Coretta Scott King of Atlanta, Georgia, founder of the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Center, and winner of the Doug Hammarskjöld Award. And the third person is Lupe Anguiano of Texas, a founder of the National Women's Political Caucus and a leading spokeswoman for welfare reform and welfare rights. Now please clear the aisles so that we may hear the reading of this impressive preamble by these very special women.
We are here to move history forward.
We are women from every state and territory in the nation.
We are women of different ages, beliefs, and lifestyles.
We are women of many economic, social, political, racial, ethnic, cultural, educational, and religious backgrounds.
We are married, single, widowed, and divorced. We are mothers and daughters.
We are sisters.
We speak in varied accents and languages, but we share in the common language and experience of American women who throughout our nation's life have been denied the opportunities, rights, privileges, and responsibilities afforded to men.
For the first time in the more than 200 years of our democracy, we are gathered in a national women's conference charged under federal law to assess the status of women in our country, to measure the progress we have made, to identify the barriers that prevent us from participating fully and equally in all aspects of national life, and to make recommendations to the President and to the Congress for means by which such barriers can be removed.
We recognize the positive changes that have occurred in the lives of women since the founding of our nation, and more than a century of struggle, from Seneca Falls 1848 to Houston 1977, we have progressed from being non-persons and slaves whose work and achievements were unrecognized, whose needs were ignored, and whose rights were suppressed, to being citizens with freedoms and aspirations of which our ancestors could only dream.
We can vote and own property. We work in the home, in our communities, and in every occupation. We are 40% of the labor force. We are in the arts, sciences, professions, and politics. We raise children, govern states, head businesses and institutions. We climb mountains, explore the ocean depths, and reach out toward the moon.
Our lives no longer end with the childbearing years. Our lifespan has increased to more than 75 years. We have become a majority of the population, 51.3%. And by the 21st century, we shall be even a larger majority.
But despite some gains made in the past 200 years, our dream of equality is still withheld from us, and millions of women still face a daily reality of discrimination, limited opportunities and economic hardship, man-made barriers, laws, social customs and prejudices continue to keep a majority of women in an inferior position without full control of our lives and our bodies.
From infancy throughout life, in personal and in public relationships, in the family, in the schools, in every occupation and profession, too often we find our individuality, our earning powers, diminished by discriminatory practices and outmoded ideas of what a woman is, what a woman can do, and what a woman must be.
Increasingly, we are victims of crimes of violence in a culture that degrades us as sex objects and promotes pornography for profit.
We are poorer than men, and those of us who are minority women, blacks, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, and Asian Americans, must overcome the double burden of discrimination based on race and sex.
We lack effective and political and economic power. We have only minor and insignificant roles in making, interpreting, and enforcing our laws, in running political parties, businesses, unions, schools, and institutions, in directing the media, in governing our country, in deciding issues of war and peace.
We do not seek special privileges. But we demand, as a human right, a full voice and role for women in determining the destiny of our world, our nation, our families, and our individual lives. We seek these rights for all women, whether or not they choose as individuals to use them.
We are a part of a worldwide movement of women who believe that only by bringing women into full partnership with men and respecting our rights as half the human race can we hope to achieve a world in which the whole human race, men, women, and children, can live in peace and prosperity.
Based on the views of women who have met in every state and territory in the past year, the National Plan of Action is presented to the President and the Congress as our recommendations for implementing Public Law 94-167.
We are entitled to, and we expect, serious attention to our proposals.
We demand immediate and continuing action on our national plan by federal, state, public, and private institutions so that by 1985, the end of the International Decade for Women proclaimed by the United Nations, everything possible under the law will have been done to provide American women with full equality.
The rest will be up to the hearts, minds, and moral consciences of men and women, and what they do to make our society truly democratic and open to all.
We pledge with all the strength of our dedication to this struggle to form a more perfect union.
For the purpose of introducing the proposed motion on arts and humanities, Commissioner Connie Plunkett of Georgia.
The first resolution is arts and humanities. I move the adoption of the following resolution. The president should take steps to require that women, number one, are assured equal opportunities for appointment to managerial and upper level posts in federally funded cultural institutions such as libraries, museums, universities, and public radio and TV. Two, are more equitably represented on grant awarding boards, commissions, and panels. Three, benefit more fairly from government grants, whether as individual grant applicants or as members of cultural institutions receiving federal or state funding. Judging agencies and review boards should use blind judgings for musicians, including singers, in appraising them for employment, awards, and fellowships, as well as for all articles and papers being considered for publication or delivery, and for all exhibits and grant applications wherever possible.
It has been moved and seconded that the conference adopt the resolution on arts and humanities as it appears before you.